Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Take a listen to this comment from a guy that lives in Cleveland.
I took the dog for a walk. I was down the street. I walked away about, I was 4 minutes away when it blew up. And if I hadn't had a dog, I'd be dead.
And then listen to this.
While the losses are high, that we had fully forecasted for them, and the $32 billion we have in total reserves right now is more than enough to cover all forecasted losses.
Now, tell me what those two comments have in common. Think hard. The answer is foreclosures, connecting unlikely dots on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. I can't believe it's already Wednesday, but it is Wednesday, February 3rd. And The Takeaway for me is we're in a strange place when a home exploding in Cleveland is part of our foreclosure problem.
Well, the ripple effect of foreclosures throughout urban neighborhoods throughout the United States is a huge economic story, and that's what we're going to be talking about a little bit later. But let's get right to the top stories. Toyota's winter of discontent continues. Its sales dropped 16% last month. Now we're getting word there may be brake problems with the popular Prius hybrid. The Prius is not part of the worldwide recall, but U.S. regulators have received about 100 complaints about its brakes. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says the U.S. government had to pressure Toyota to take action over those sticking gas pedals.
Maybe they were a little safety deaf in their North American office until we went to Japan.
Also, federal regulators have launched an inquiry into whether faulty engine electronics may be behind the accelerator problems.
The housing report card is not pretty. In the past 2 years, the housing market has lost an estimated $5 trillion in value. And nearly 6 million homes have now gone into foreclosure. We're joined now by Ida Liaskovsky, a reporter for WCPN in Cleveland. Ida, the house exploded in Cleveland on Monday, and that's related to the foreclosure problem, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, a lot of these foreclosed houses end up getting dumped.
And that's what happened to this one?
Right, and many of them get dumped to absentee landlords, which was the case in this house. The landlord, the owner, actually lived in California. And these absentee landlords often don't look after the houses. People come and go. These houses get looted. They fall apart. They're unkept. And usually it's just an eyesore for the community. But in this case, it actually turned out to be a huge safety hazard.
Okay. Ida Liaskovsky from WCPN Cleveland. Stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Now to Haiti. The latest on those 10 American missionaries arrested for trying to leave the country with a busload of children. Yesterday, an investigator questioned the five women in the group for hours and will meet with the five men today. And the findings will be presented to the Haitian district attorney, who will then decide whether to prosecute. The Baptist group, mostly from Idaho, say they were only trying to help orphans survive, but the head of Haiti's social welfare agency says the group enlisted a clergyman who went knocking on doors asking people if they wanted to give away their children.
Chilling words from the director of national intelligence. Dennis Blair told a Senate hearing yesterday Al-Qaeda will almost certainly try a major attack on the U.S. in the next 3 to 6 months. In the same hearing, CIA Director Leon Panetta said the group is deploying recruits to the U.S. to carry out new attacks from within.
It's the lone wolf strategy that I think we have to pay attention to as a threat to this country.
Panetta also said the terrorists are becoming harder to detect and are moving more quickly than in the past. This comes as three U.S. soldiers were killed this morning in a bomb blast near the Pakistan-Afghan border. Also this morning, a bomb attack at the inauguration of a girls' school in Pakistan killed at least six people, including three U.S. aid workers. And here at home, our partner, the New York Times, reports AIG planning to pay out about $100 million in fresh bonuses to employees of its financial products division. Looking at the markets, futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,296, the S&P at 1,103, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,190. So you may have heard that the Super Bowl is coming this Sunday. We're going to talk later about party foods for the Super Bowl, a New Orleans-inspired menu.
And we have a musical challenge for you folks.
We are the world. We are the children.
The new version of this famous We Are the World song debuts about Haiti next week. But maybe the song needs an update. Update the lyrics of We Are the World, We Are the Children. And then what? Tell us or sing it at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the foreclosure reality.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. You know, one of the things that we like to do on The Takeaway is give you a statistic and then help you understand what it really means with a concrete example. So here's the statistic. Nearly 6 million households have been foreclosed on in the past 3 years. Here's the concrete example. A home in Cleveland exploded, not only destroying the homes, but several of the homes around it, where some city residents got a firsthand look at what it means when houses are vacant. We're joined again by Ida Liaskovsky. She's a reporter for WCPN in Cleveland. Now, Ida, there is some question about whether this was arson rather than a gas problem in the home.
Right. So Cleveland fire investigators have ruled it intentional, and they've posted signs in the neighborhood to see if anyone knows anything about arson. But we've yet to hear the final word on what was the cause of the fire or the explosion.
But regardless of what the cause is, it's still really a problem of what happens when a home is vacant and unattended.
Exactly. So the owner of this house, they actually bought this house from a couple, but they live in California. It's a company called Easy Access Funding LLC. And they've also gotten dozens of houses from, for example, the Housing and Urban Development, who dump foreclosed houses to companies like Easy Access LLC. And these absentee landlords don't generally come to check out the houses. They never see them. And these houses go unkept and untaken care of.
How much do they pay for these homes on average?
Well, on average, houses that are dumped from the major players, they get a couple $100s. For example, houses that Easy Access did buy from HUD, they went for $500.
Okay, so how is this a common problem in Cleveland? I mean, when you go to Cleveland, are there a lot of vacant homes?
Absolutely. On this street alone, a neighbor was telling me that they can see 10 houses, a dozen more houses that are sitting in the same unkept, uncared for condition. And they're absolutely forlorn, and people come and go, and they're looted and not watched over at all.
Okay, Ida Liaskovsky, reporter for WCPN Cleveland, giving us a concrete example of the foreclosure problem when it comes down to the street level. For some analysis, let's go to our next guest, Brett Berry. He's the associate broker for HomeSmart in Phoenix. Brett, you work in Arizona, obviously, but you're watching the entire national picture. And the Washington Post and some others have reported that the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, is in trouble because a borrower is falling behind in their loans. Unfortunately, nobody from the FHA was able to join us this morning, but we spoke with FHA Commissioner David Stevens, and he had this to say.
While the numbers are high, we had forecasted for these numbers. We have reserves to pay losses based on those numbers, and there's nothing out of the ordinary that we're seeing that we didn't already expect. So it's bad, but we had anticipated it, and we've reserved for it.
What do you think? Should we be alarmed by these numbers coming out of the FHA?
Very much so. You know, we've heard these types of comments before. As a matter of fact, if we look back about a year or a year and a half ago, I think we heard similar comments as Mr. Stevens is mentioning from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. There were a lot of questions being asked to Fannie and Freddie. They were government-sponsored entities regarding their reserves and whether things were okay. We kept hearing, and they kept telling everyone that everything was okay. And I think we know by now that things are not okay. And I think what consumers, you know, on a very simple level just need to do is just kind of look around their neighborhoods, especially in places like Phoenix, and they will see that the numbers of foreclosures is continuing to grow, and that is putting huge pressures on FHA. Real briefly, FHA basically insures loans. They don't make loans. A lot of people don't understand what FHA really does. And so what Mr. Stevens was saying is that he was alluding to their required reserves. FHA basically came into being in the mid-1930s, and they have to keep a requirement of about 2% of reserves, and that requirement has been in place since 1934. And since 1934, they've never dipped below that 2% reserves until now. And they're now at 0.50% of their required reserves. That's required by law.
Okay. Now, the point, as you were saying, they don't issue loans. But what the FHA is intended to do is help people who don't have a full down payment to actually buy a home. And this is what FHA Commissioner David Stevens had to say about their mission in terms of helping hardworking families who can afford to make those payments but can't afford big down payments.
If you look at the FHA performance, low down payment loans work very effectively with credit-worthy borrowers, borrowers with FICO scores and proven histories of ability to pay their loans. over time.
What's your response to that, the mission of the FHA?
Well, I think that it's a very admirable mission. And, you know, folks like the National Association of Realtors, the NAR, and others, other lobbyists for the bankers' associations that are pushing these loans, you know, would love to continue to dole out loans with, you know, 3.5% down payments. The problem here, Celeste, is that the mortgage companies out there in the banks are using these loans in almost the same way as the zero down loans of the crazy go-go days. And if you call most local brokers who do these mortgages, they love FHA loans. FHA loans used to comprise about maybe 2-3% of all loans back in 06. Right now, here in Phoenix, it's over 50% of all loans. So now what we have, Celeste, is a situation of two, really almost too big to fail. And I have one more question that I would ask Mr. Stevens there at FHA. Why is it a God-given right that everyone should get a loan with 3.5% down payment? Very admirable. But why is that a right?
He kind of answers that question. Let me give you his answer.
No, not everybody should own a home. If there's one lesson we've learned from this crisis we've come through, is that's one of the first mistakes that was made.
So that's his answer. Not everyone has a God-given right.
Well, you know what? FHA reminds me of someone that they basically got their foot on the gas full speed and their foot on the brake pedal at the same time. And that's pretty much what I see right now with FHA. They're juicing it up on one end and they're putting it on a dead stop on the other, talking about FICO scores and great quality loans. But I really don't, I don't believe what he's saying, not one bit.
Okay, we're getting some negative news from the FHA, but the news on the housing market overall, we've had kind of mixed. There's some good news there as well, so hopefully we will see some rise in housing values over the next few months. Brett Berry is an associate broker for HomeSmart in Phoenix. Just a note, you can see pictures of the foreclosed house that exploded in Cleveland on our website, thanks to Ida Liaskovsky of WCPN. Just stop by thetakeaway.org. Now let's check in on the news headlines at 15 minutes past the hour.
The U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says his department had to pressure Toyota to take that action on faulty gas pedals we've been reporting all week. Now LaHood says his department will check up on other automakers.
Given what's happened to Toyota, our people are going to, you know, look at that and consider it and talk to car manufacturers about that. It would just be the common sense thing to do.
Federal regulators are looking into whether engine electronics caused vehicles to accelerate unexpectedly as experts cast doubt on Toyota's explanation for the runaway cars. Moving abroad in a major shift in Iranian policy, the country says it's ready to send its uranium abroad for further enrichment. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says Iran will have no problem giving the West its low-enriched uranium and taking it back a few months later when it's enriched by 20%. That's a turnaround from a few months ago.
Back at home in an Illinois primary yesterday, voters choose who will battle over President Obama's Senate seat. Democrat Alexei Janulis will run against Republican Mark Kirk. Republicans have targeted that Senate seat since former Governor Rod Blagojevich was arrested for trying to sell it. And in Washington, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen says it is time to repeal the military's don't ask, don't tell policy and allow gay troops to serve openly in the military. He talked about that during testimony before the Armed Services Committee yesterday. We're going to be talking more about that hearing with D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick in just a few minutes. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our takeouts this morning include the voices of listeners out there, but also two contributors, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Morning, John.
And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports contributor right here in the studio. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
Todd, let's begin with you. The big story on Capitol Hill kind of crept up on me anyway. Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and we spoke with him down in Washington when I was there with you just a couple of weeks ago. Very straight shooter in our interview and certainly in front of Capitol Hill. A straight shooter calling for it's time to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, claiming it was his personal belief, but a process is suddenly set in motion. How did that go down in Congress?
Well, you're right, John. Admiral Mike Mullen, the chief number one ranked uniformed officer in the United States military, saying it's time to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, said it as well. But Mullen really carried the most weight. You know, presidents have talked about ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense can ask for it, but they're civilians. Mullen is brass. And when the brass says it's time to end it, that carries enormous weight on the Hill. You had a chorus of these officials yesterday saying it's time to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And it was a chorus. And I talked with Senator Jeff Sessions, a member of the Armed Services Committee, a Republican member, just after the hearing, who already feels like Republicans are kind of getting steamrolled on this issue. He thinks Don't Ask, Don't Tell is working just fine. So listen to what he had to say.
We've got the president, the commander-in-chief, the secretary of defense, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying they've made up their mind. But this is a congressional requirement by law. They don't have the ability to decide this and change it without a national, you know, some sort of discussion worthy of the issue.
And Senator Sessions had some tough questions for Joint Chiefs Chairman Mike Mullen, Admiral Mike Mullen.
He did. And several of the Republicans did, presenting letters from, you know, 1,000 or so retired generals saying Don't Ask, Don't Tell is working. It shouldn't be repealed. But the Pentagon says it's going ahead with this, but they can't repeal it overnight and they won't try. And Gates has said that what they may try to do now is have kind of a year-long transitional period. They want to study this for a year. Now, studying something in Washington means kicking it until after the election, which is probably what they're doing.
It's a cynical view, but they were We're talking about actually exploring what the views were throughout the enlisted ranks.
They are doing that. But in the meantime, they are talking about making some changes. And I talked to Senator Carl Levin quickly, who's chairman of Armed Services, gave me a sense of what they might do between now and an actual repeal if they get a repeal. One, they may decide that a member of the military who's gay or lesbian can't be outed by a third party.
Right.
Can't be on someone else's say-so. If you are outed or if you come out now and you're discharged from the military under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you only get half of what's called your separation pay for an honorable discharge. They would give you full pay under this transitional period. Third, they may have a moratorium on discharges pending this review. None of these things is decided yet, but Levin said that in this year long, if they have this transitional period, they may make these changes to kind of ease into an end.
Winds of change on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thank you.
And now let's move on to sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We are counting down the days till the Super Bowl between the New Orleans Saints and the Indianapolis Colts. By focusing on some of the people playing on these teams that maybe you haven't heard of or working for the teams in this particular case, today we're going to talk about the Colts defensive coordinator, Larry Coyer. And the Colts defense wasn't what the Colts were really known for. They've been known for their offensive line. So how did this guy, Larry Coyer, turn it around?
Well, first I want to tell you, when I played in college football, I played under two defensive coordinators. The first guy would scare you to death. He would absolutely scare you to death. He was more of a drill sergeant. The second guy had a different demeanor. He was calm. He was relaxed. He would make fun. He would try and connect with the players. He would try and teach you. Coyer strikes me as the second type of guy. There's two different styles of coaching. People describe Coyer as a player's coach, and that's Larry Coyer.
And so you feel like he's turned this around not through ruling by fear, but by trying to help people get better.
I would say that he uses his storytelling ability. He's 66 years old. He's coached for 42 years, so he really came of age in a different era. So he uses basic memes and basic principles to really connect with players. And the other thing that he does is that he has fun. He makes things light. He makes things happy. And I think what he does is he rallies people around him, and I think he doesn't make it as serious and as intense, and he draws the best out of the players. So he has a very typical teaching style. He finds a way to connect with each player, and then he draws the best out of them.
This sounds great, except the Saints' offensive line is no joke. I mean, is the Colts' defense going to be strong enough to resist the Saints?
So the Saints have multiple threats. They have multiple looks. They're a well-oiled machine. The problem with the Colts this week is that their defensive end, Dwight Freeney, is injured. He has an ankle injury. So look to see how Larry Coyer rallies his troops around his injury and fills that gap. That is going to be the key to this victory if the Colts are going to claim a victory in the Super Bowl.
Thanks, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor.
Good morning.
Our last takeout, kind of a surprise, the number of responses we got from you guys on the unemployed getting help from their friends and family and what kind of dynamic that creates. We heard this story at 877-8-MY-TAKE with how one listener got help from a friend named Sam.
This is Kelly from Pittsburgh. My husband's been unemployed since May, but luckily, as of January, he enrolled full-time back into college with his GI Bill. He was formerly in the Air Force, and we've both been able to stay in our home and be able to afford basic living expenses due to the housing allowance with the full-time 11 GI Bill. So we're very thankful to Uncle Sam.
And while many people are looking for jobs, it might be time for one group to call it quits TV shows. Last night marking the beginning of the final season of Lost, and we wondered what other show out there could benefit from an expiration date.
This is Johnny from Michigan. Remember back in the day when we used to have actual spinoffs and that was the way the network created loyalty for a show? Well, now we have the parallel shows. We have three different CSIs, and I love CSIs, but I'm really tired of it. There's just way too many crazies in Nevada, and there are way too many drug dealers in Florida, and there are way too many people who have a grudge against Mac in New York. It's time. Let's go.
Great suggestions.
Something's got to keep the economy going.
We also got a lot more than that yesterday about TV shows that need to end at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can also post your suggestions to our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, was the crash of a small flight in Buffalo last year because of how pilots at small airlines are treated?
You know, by the time it all got said and done, we're literally starving at the end of the day.
The problem of flying cheap with our friend Miles O'Brien in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, flying cheap may have meant flying dangerously for some tragic victims of a crash in Buffalo a year ago. A look into that with our friend Miles O'Brien in just a few moments. But right now, let's check in on top stories. At 30 minutes after the hour, the nation's top intelligence officials described it as, quote, certain that Al-Qaeda will try to attack the U.S. in the next 3 to 6 months. CIA Director Leon Panetta told a Senate hearing yesterday the terror group is deploying so-called clean recruits who have a negligible trail of terrorist contacts to the U.S.
I think the greater threat is that Al-Qaeda is adapting their methods in ways that oftentimes make it difficult to detect.
The attempted Christmas Day bomber is reportedly aiding intelligence officials in the fight against Al-Qaeda. Officials say he's been cooperating with investigators since last week after the FBI asked his family in Nigeria to help persuade him to talk.
In Pakistan, the five Americans arrested on suspicion of plotting terror attacks have once again claimed they're being tortured in jail. Muslim activist Khalid Khaja has met face-to-face with the Americans in prison.
They told me that from the first day, they have been extremely tortured by various authorities, and they don't know why. They have not been told any of their crime. They have not been told what they have done.
Their trial was supposed to begin yesterday, but was postponed until later this month. There's been another attack this morning targeting Shiite pilgrims in Iraq. Officials say a bomb on a parked motorcycle killed at least 20 at a religious ceremony in the holy city of Karbala. Across the border in Iran, the government says it's ready to send its uranium abroad for further enrichment, as requested by the United Nations. It's a major shift in Iran's position. The next question is where that uranium will be shipped, with Turkey, France, or Japan all possible destinations. Here at home, Toyota may be reeling, with its sales dropping 16% last month due to a worldwide recall, but the rest of the U.S. auto industry is looking up. GM, Ford, Nissan, and Hyundai all posted double-digit sales increases in the U.S. last quarter. Sales rose 6% overall. Let's check in on the markets now. Asian and European markets are up, futures are mixed, and the Dow will start at 10,296. The S&P opens at 1,103 and the NASDAQ at 2,190. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Bitter revelations yesterday, unlikely to produce closure for the victims of a crash a year ago. The National Transportation and Safety Board revealed the results of their almost year-long investigation into the crash of that Colgan Air flight in Buffalo, New York last year. The report said that the crash was caused by pilot error. that it was the pilot's complacency and confusion that resulted in this catastrophe. While the NTSB was looking for answers, aviation reporter Miles O'Brien was conducting his own investigation into that crash and into the whole issue of low-cost flying in the United States. He talked to former Colgan Air pilots, and here's former Colgan pilot Chris Wicken.
The investigation of 3407 opened a window into the lives of regional pilots. Where the work is hard and the days are long, says former Colgan pilot Chris Wicken.
It's challenging. It's very challenging. A lot of short routes, a lot of takeoffs, a lot of landings, and going in and out of bad weather, being down low, especially at Colgan, flying the turboprops, you're not flying above the weather, you're flying in the weather. You know, 8, 9, 10 flights a day, it gets to be a very long day.
A very long day. You can hear the voice there of Miles O'Brien reporting that for Frontline, produced by our partner WGBH. The Frontline documentary is called Flying Cheap. And it will air next Tuesday, February 9th. Miles was the reporter on that, and you can hear him in the story there. Miles, right in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So, you know, you looked at Colgan Air, but this is really a portrait of the difficulties and maybe some of the problems unearthed by that Colgan Air crash that relate to low-cost commuter air flying throughout the United States.
Yeah, a lot of people picking up their papers or surfing the web this morning are going to see a headline which says it was pilot error which caused that crash a year ago.
Right.
But it's much deeper and much broader than that. That's what our investigation found out. What we've had happen here without really realizing it is the airline industry has evolved into an outsourcing model.
Right.
And now fully 51% of all the flying in this country is done by these small regional or commuter airlines. And the big question is there two standards of safety with this system? Are these smaller regional airlines, are they at the same levels that their big players are? When you get in an airplane with that Continental logo, you think you're getting Continental
right.
service and safety. Not so.
So the system of hubs that we're familiar with when we travel has also produced this system of mini sort of air routes that sort of make up for the deficiencies that the hub system doesn't serve.
Precisely. This goes back to deregulation and the whole
right.
idea of hub and spoke and how do you feed those hubs.
And here's another pilot I got the pronunciation right. This is Corey Heiser. You interviewed him, right? And he's a Colgan Air pilot who talks about the conditions under which these folks work.
We are only paid when the door's closed and the engines are running. As soon as we block out of the gate, we close that door. That's when we start. All the time we're walking through airports, eating lunch, reading a book, while we wait for airplanes, standing at the gate. You know, we're not paid for that time. We may be on duty for 80 hours a week and get paid for 20 of it, if we're lucky.
Again, an excerpt from the WGBH-produced Frontline piece that Miles O'Brien reported. You know, the NTSB said that the pilots in that Colgan Air crash were acting as though the flight was simply a means for them to have a conversation. Does that behavior come out of this idea that we're struggling, we're working long hours, hand to mouth, flying is often an afterthought?
Well, first off, nothing excuses the actions of those pilots.
Sure.
That was one of the most egregious cases of pilot error and inattention I can imagine. I read these transcripts all the time. I've never read anything quite like that. Having said that, what we discovered is the foundation, the roots of this, are a system which treats these pilots poorly. They're not paid well. They're tired. They're in a system which, as one the pilots told us, says push the rig, move the rig. The regionals get paid only if they fly from point A to point B within a certain period of time, arrive on time. It has nothing to do with anything else as far as their payment. They don't have a situation where safety is rewarded.
So they may be in a nice uniform up there in the cockpit, but it feels like a sweatshop to them in their lives.
Sweatshop is a good term, and that has come to mind many times in doing this.
Here's Corey Heiser again describing what you actually conclude in this documentary is a two-tiered pay scale between the regional carriers and the major carriers.
My first year was, I made a little over $22,000 gross.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put into the fact that you have, you know, mortgages and rent for a crash pad, student loan payments, car insurance and whatnot. You know, by the time it all got said and done, we were literally starving at the end of the day.
Now, again, you want to stress that no matter what your financial situation, it doesn't excuse pilot error or negligence in the cockpit, but maybe flying consumers should know a few of these details.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We all want that cheap ticket. And I think we're getting what we're paying for at this point. We've created a system that is not as safe as we think it is. And that airplane, that smaller airplane that may have that major airline logo on it, is not flying under the same set of standards that you're used to.
So what's the upgrade here? What's the way, and literally it is an upgrade?
Well, it really, this cries out for some government intervention. The FAA needs to step in and raise the minimum standards, because the regionals do meet their minimum standards. The majors just go above and beyond what the FAA requires. So it's important for the FAA to step in here and change the rules on fatigue, perhaps address these issues of pilot pay, address these
issues. Let's just hold on pilot pay for a second. Do you think a pilot is a safer pilot if he's salaried rather than punching the clock every time he gets into the cockpit?
If you're making $16,000 a year and you got to live in Seattle with your parents and commute all the way across the country to sign in at Newark in the morning in order to get on your plane, are you safer? No.
All right.
That's an untenable situation.
All right. So any likelihood that the government is going to address these things?
This is a watershed accident. There is a lot of action right now. We got to hold them to accountable for this, because
small,
we need some change.
Small plane, big issue. Miles O'Brien, a friend of The Takeaway, science and aviation reporter. He's the reporter in a new documentary, Flying Cheap. It airs February 9th on our partners WGBH in Boston, the Frontline program. Coming up, we host the Super Bowl of food. We make a party menu with flavors of Miami, New Orleans, and Indiana. Hey, thanks for coming by, Miles. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. According to Iran, it successfully test-fired a new rocket designed to carry satellites into orbit, and that's raising new concerns about Iran's missile capability. Here's Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad speaking on Iranian state TV this morning.
We are two more steps away from reaching a point of no return, to a point where we bring all the skies under the domain of Iranian scientists.
Okay, that comment comes at the same time that President Ahmadinejad says he's willing to go ahead, after all, on a deal on Iran's nuclear program. Joining us now to explain is the BBC's Tehran correspondent, John Lyne. He joins us from London. Good morning, John.
Yes, good morning to you.
Let's deal with the first issue of this. President Ahmadinejad's statement that they are two steps away from being the skies being under the domain of Iran. What does that mean?
Well, I'm not sure even he knows precisely, but I think it was being taken as slightly ominous by certainly those countries who are afraid of Iran. Here's this demonstration of Iran's capability. Yes, peaceful. They even put some animals on board to give a real live demonstration of that. Mouse, turtles, some worms. But at the same time, it shows Iran can send projectiles a very long way, and that will scare the United States and other countries. Scare, certainly give them a wake-up call anyway.
Is that a real fear of in terms of surprising us over their capabilities?
There's a very real fear about Iran's missile program, which is steadily extending the range. And, of course, the nightmare scenario is an Iranian long-range missile combined with a nuclear bomb. We're not there yet. I don't think anybody thinks Iran is actually making a bomb, although it seems to be making ready to have that capability. Then they would have to take it another step to miniaturize it, to put it on top of one of these missiles. Nevertheless, they're making progress, and that is worrying the world. And that is also seen, and tests like this are seen as a very aggressive steps by Iran.
Okay, this comes, as we said, at the same time that they've announced that they are agreeing to a deal on the nuclear program to send uranium abroad for enrichment and exchange it for fuel. And this seems kind of a common tactic for Iran, that in one take, they take a very belligerent, strong stance to declaring Iran's dominance. And in the other one, they quietly negotiate a compromise.
Well, if it is a compromise, and I think there'll be a degree of scepticism here. Iran first agreed this deal in principle in October. Then it seemed to go back on it because of domestic pressure against it. Now suddenly Mr. Ahmadinejad, who couldn't seem to be able to deliver that deal if he wanted to, says it's no problem, we can sign the deal, no issue at all. So there'll be scepticism about whether they are going to deliver or whether this is just a tactic to divide those countries which are at the moment negotiating on new sanctions against Iran. And we've seen already Russia, of course, a key country that can veto new sanctions, saying, oh, this is interesting, let's have some more talks about this.
So you think that perhaps President Ahmadinejad will not follow through yet again on this deal to exchange for enriched uranium?
Well, I think a degree of scepticism will certainly be in order until and if he delivers. If he does, I'm sure this will be welcomed by the West, by the outside world, as something that could at least put the the program or the fears about the program on hold for a year or so.
Okay, John Lyon is the BBC Tehran correspondent. He reported from London on two pieces of news coming from Iran. One, they have successfully test-fired a rocket that will carry satellites into orbit. And two, they say they're willing to sign a deal on their nuclear program.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Well, the game is long, the commercials are many, and some old guys at halftime, The Who, yeah, we'll be able to see the wrinkles on their faces. But you got to eat during the Super Bowl, right? Super Bowl cuisine, way beyond sliced carrots and chips. Two chefs talking about the cuisines of Miami, New Orleans, and Indianapolis in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check of leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Department of Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says his department had to pressure Toyota into taking that action on faulty gas pedals. Now federal regulators are investigating whether the sudden accelerator problems are a result of electronic failures. Abroad, a major shift in Iranian policy we were just discussing. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad now says he will ship uranium abroad for enrichment. But one Iranian expert says the decision raises a key question. Where will the uranium go?
The devil is in the detail. Who's going to do it? When are they? Are they going to go through Russia and France, which I suspect that will not be the case. But they could go through Japan. They could go through Turkey, countries that both Iran sort of trusts and the U.S. trusts.
In other news, the Iranian president has proposed a prisoner swap of Iranians in U.S. prisons for three American hikers now being held in Iran.
The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, has been influencing the world's oil supply for 50 years. But the BBC's Leslie Kerwin just spoke with OPEC's Secretary General Abdallah El-Badri, and she joins us now from London. Leslie, what did El-Badri say about how member states are flooding the markets with cheaper oil?
Well, the Secretary General was telling me, first of all, that the recession is over, the economic recovery is fragile. He talked about demand being slow. I should tell you, by the way, that about a quarter of America's oil comes from OPEC nations. That's why it's particularly relevant to you. And he said he wants to make sure that the recovery is sustainable. He's pleased to see the latest US growth figures. But most of the demand, the growing demand, is coming from China and India. Now, what really is interesting is that he admitted that some of his own members, OPEC's own members, have been churning out more oil, much more oil than they'd promised to under agreed production cuts.
And here's what he had to say about to you about whether or not OPEC is losing control of its member states.
We don't sanction them. We just urge them that they abide by the decision that we take at any meeting. It's a gentleman agreement.
The member states are part of a gentleman's agreement?
It's a bit surprising, isn't it? He has absolutely no sanctions at all to make them stick to the production cuts that they've agreed to. His worry is that the oil prices will fall if there's too much production. And what that could mean in turn is that there'll be less investment in new fields, new oil. When the big upturn in the world economy comes, and it will, there won't be enough supply for that demand.
Okay, that's Leslie Kerwin. She's a correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Thank you.
Ah, yes, the soundtrack to the big game this weekend, the Super Bowl. It's long, halftime commercials. The game itself can be long. You have to eat during Sunday. The game gets underway at something like 6:45 p.m. What are you going to do if you have a Super Bowl party way beyond slicing up celery and carrots and opening bags of chips and melting cheese? Oh, my God. Super Bowl cuisine has advanced so far from those early days. And joining us now is Michael Schwartz, the chef and owner of Michael's Genuine Food and Drink in Miami. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
And
good
right morning. Right there with you is Jonathan Wright, executive chef of the Setai, right?
That's right. Good morning.
And that's a restaurant there in Miami. To both of you, Jonathan and Michael, what are you recommending for a Super Bowl cuisine that is both exciting, maybe even more exciting than the game? Super Bowl games don't necessarily have a reputation for being particularly exciting, and also doable for home chefs. Michael?
Well, I think the biggest thing to keep in mind is that the Super Bowl reaches such a broad audience that people aren't just interested in pizza, like you said, and dip and chip. So, you know, here in Miami, you'll see a lot of pigs roasting in La Caja China, and lots of black beans and rice and vibrant flavors that, you know, take advantage of what's happening now in South Florida.
Now, you know, we've got the options here of exploring Miami's cuisine because the game is going to be in Miami. We've got New Orleans cuisine because, of course, one of the teams is the New Orleans Saints. And we've got Indianapolis, the Colts. I have to say, Jonathan Wright, that at least in the cuisine side, Indianapolis would seem something of an underdog here. Would you agree?
Yeah, I could.
You don't have to agree. You don't have to agree.
I'm actually fortunate that I spent 4.5 years in New Orleans and moved into that in late 2005 after Katrina. So New Orleans is very, very close to my heart. And, you know, we'll be doing some dirty rice and some beignets and we'll have a pot of gumbo on the stove stirring and some great cocktails and so on. But I think Indianapolis, it's... we're certainly going to do, you know, we'll do some variations of a corn dog and maybe some pork patties and some great sandwiches and burgers. But it's they're a bit shy of the cuisine that's coming out of New Orleans in Miami. That's for
sure. No one can compete with New Orleans. Let's just say that right off the top. Michael Schwartz, is that a good strategy for a Super Bowl kind of party to have something that's cooking on the stove, say a gumbo or a stew or something like a pig roast where people can just sort of slice and go back to the TV?
Yeah, that's the best strategy. The worst strategy is for people to have to wait for food. So as people come in and out, and you said the game's long and it goes on for a long period of time, there's got to be stuff ready, prepared, that people can come and grab and go.
All right, Jonathan, tell me about your fried green tomatoes with shrimp remoulade and a Creole julep to boot.
Okay, well, the recipe for that comes from a restaurant up in the Garden District called Upper Line. Susan Clevenger and the chef there, Ken Smith, and... I go back every year for Jazz Fest, and every year I go back to Upper Line. And they have simple fried green tomatoes. It's about half-inch thick green tomatoes. They're floured and dipped in cornmeal and fried. We'd make a classic remoulade sauce with Creole mustard, ketchup, hot sauce, emulsified with oil, red peppers and tomato.
Fabulous.
And then you take in these, you know, fantastic Gulf shrimp that we're fortunate to get here as well, the wild Gulf shrimp, you know, poach them, you know, just lightly mixed up with the remoulade sauce, and then they just sit on top of the fried green tomatoes. And it's just a great combination of the crispness and so on and the wonderful shrimp. And then, you know, there's no better place for the New Orleans for classic cocktails, and we do a kind of a spin on a Ramos Gin Fizz, where the satay is a very Asian property. So we've taken a Ramos Gin Fizz and thrown in there some coconut milk and some yuzu and some lime leaf and turned that around.
So,
interpretation.
That's Jonathan Wright, executive chef of the Satay, which is a Asian fusion restaurant there in Miami, right?
It's a hotel. The Satay is a Southeast Asian hotel, and right. One of the main restaurants is Asian, yep.
Michael Schwartz, given that, you might say that Super Bowl Sunday is one day that all of America celebrates men who weigh about 340 pounds and can lift up a house, is fried food maybe the reason why, or is that maybe the reason why there's so much fried food in these Super Bowl parties?
First of all, I want to say I'm going to Jonathan's to eat. That sounded good. You could talk a lot about fried food and the, you know, what's great about it and what the problem is with fried food, and I think it certainly has its place, and I would say that certainly Super Bowl Sunday is a time and a place for fried food.
But tell me about your chicken wings with papaya slaw and genuine margarita.
Yeah. The chicken wings, the great thing about chicken wings is that, you know, you could fry them or bake them. So if you feel like a little bit of guilt, you could pop them in the oven, just make sure that they're crispy. The thing with the chicken wings is that they don't, you know, it doesn't have to be about buffalo, certainly not this Super Bowl. So the chicken wings has a real nice tangy sauce. It's got lots of components, but tahini-based and, you know, bright, vibrant flavors. And we paired that with a green papaya slaw. So, you know, we're at the height of our growing season here in South Florida, which is the complete opposite of the rest of the country.
Well,
so we're seeing... Go ahead.
Well, you know, the game is Sunday, and in Miami, the New Orleans Saints are one of the teams, the Indianapolis Colts the other team. The Colts are favored. At the end of the game, of the whole spectacle, do you think the gumbo pot's going to be empty and there'll be a pile of those Indianapolis corn dogs on the table if your party consists of both cuisines? Michael, quickly.
No, I think people will eat whatever you put out.
And of course, that is perfectly right. Jonathan Wright, lads, take us out.
I think that's who's going to win.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the question.
Jonathan Wright, executive chef of the Setai, and Michael Schwartz, chef owner of Michael's Genuine Food and Drink, handicapping the cuisine for the Super Bowl. Thanks, guys.
We're asking our listeners for work help, actually, on another project. There was a new version of We Are the World recorded to benefit Haiti. It debuts next week. But we're wondering if we should update the lyrics, maybe. Maybe you can update them for us. Give us new lyrics to that tune from We Are the World at 8778-MY-TAKE or at our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're good.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.